Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, November 18th, 2014, after a long weekend in Los Angeles, where the Eagles came from. I'm back behind the microphone, ready to talk about Mary Landrieu selling out the Keystone XL. She's a
desperado. Why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now.
Now, I speak a little Espanol, and perhaps desperada would be the correct form.
These things
to talk about the desperate maneuvers of Mary Landrieu. And I'll get to that in just a second, but I want to mention that I had a great long weekend in L.A. Got to catch up with a cousin who's fighting cancer. Alan is doing much better than we expected and, in fact, is quite an inspiring guy. Great to see him. Also got to spend some time out on the Pacific with my friend John Glaister. I went sailing on Saturday afternoon. And just to rub it into my snowbound East Coast and Midwest and Great Plains friends, I posted a picture on Facebook of me in a T-shirt and shorts here in November. It's one of the benefits of living on the left coast. And also, I got to see the taping of Bill Maher's TV show for HBO. And I'm a regular viewer, often screaming back at the TV set. And there I was in the front row. They never show the audience, so there's no chance for you to see me if you watch the show. And I was polite. I didn't scream out. But it was very interesting to see how Maher does the show. And I got a greater sense of just how controlled the show is. It seems like a freewheeling, kind of open-ended conversation. And there is a fair amount of ad-libbing. It's not a fully scripted show. But, for example, Jeremy Scahill was there. There are many questions that he could have been asked about Ed Snowden, about Scahill's deep knowledge of Iraq and Afghanistan. And they scratched the surface on some of that in the conversations. But it's sometimes frustrating the way Maher conducts the show and how people who have quite a bit to say don't really get to say it. And so, anyway, that was my weekend in L.A. My one disappointment is that I didn't get to Burbank to see John Dist and the Distortions perform. It was late at night after the Bill Maher taping, and frankly, I couldn't convince my friends to stay up late and go clubbing. Now back to the mess in Washington, D.C. Mary Landrieu, who is not going to be reelected as a senator from Louisiana, is facing a runoff on December 6th. And so she thinks that her lifeline is to win passage of a bill in the Senate to approve the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. And it's crazy shit. It really is. We have seen. Just take, for example, the race in Kentucky, where Alison Lundgren Grimes was on track, tightening up the race with Mitch McConnell. By doing what? By separating herself from everything meaningful of the Obama administration, declaring that she's offended by the so-called war on coal, promised to fight against the EPA. And even in red states like Kentucky and Louisiana, when Democrats posture like Republicans, they lose. Now, Mary Landrieu's been doing this her entire career. She has sold out what is left of Democratic values on many occasions, putting herself first. And now her opportunism is really revealed for the nation to see. And for me, it's a foregone conclusion that Obama will serve up the Keystone XL pipeline to the Republicans when it suits him. We're already seeing the signals that even if he vetoes it upon passage by the House and Senate right now, that once the Idaho court, or it's a Nebraska court, issues a verdict on the route of the pipeline expected for January, it's likely that the White House will trade the Keystone XL for a draft pick to be named later. And this kind of horse trading always is a lose-lose proposition for Obama, because he never gets anything meaningful in return. That could change, but his record to date is really pretty sucky on that. And in an in-depth conversation with environmental journalist Mark Shapiro, which we'll release to our subscribers tomorrow here at peterbcollins.com, I recorded the conversation with Mark today. We talk about the Keystone, and I believe that environmentalists have staked too much on this single issue. Shapiro believes it's been valuable as an organizing tool, and I see that as well. But the bottom line is that this is a struggle that the correct side is going to lose. And I think that we need to rally the people who are concerned about climate change around other issues beyond the Keystone Pipeline. So we have Mary Landrieu, who is endorsing in this maneuver the bill of her opponent, a congressman from Louisiana named Cassidy. It's Bill Cassidy, right? Yeah, Bill Cassidy. And this is one of the more bizarre maneuvers that I've seen in my lifetime of watching politics. And Landrieu now has 59 of the 60 votes, she says, that she needs to get this passed by the Senate. And here's a juicy quote from Eric Pica, president of Friends of the Earth. "This house is high and dry, but the coastlines of Louisiana are sinking, very much like Senator Landrieu's political career. And she's hooking her political career on the passage of the Keystone XL pipeline that will worsen climate change, that will worsen sea level rise." So in New Orleans, when the water's rising, remember Mary Landrieu. The other action going on in the lame duck Senate relates to something, as you know, that I care very deeply about, and that is trying to regain our Fourth Amendment rights in the face of massive government surveillance of innocent Americans. And we have the wimpiest of wimpy bills, the so-called USA Freedom Act, that was passed out of the House of Representatives earlier this year. It was a weak bill to start with. It was deeply weakened behind closed doors shortly before the House passed it. And now, with some modest tweaks from Senator Pat Leahy of Vermont, the Senate is taking this up. And it doesn't fix the problem. Oh, yeah, it will provide an advocate at the FISA court for the people like you and me who are never represented there. But it's pretty toothless. And it will shift the collection of our metadata, which, of course, has always been held by the phone companies anyway. It's in our phone bill, right? They will then become the repository of all this data. And under the new rules, the NSA would have to get a special warrant to go and look at my phone records or your phone records. That's a modest improvement. But there are so many other issues, those exposed by Edward Snowden's documents and by other NSA whistleblowers. And that's just the NSA. The FBI is trampling our constitutional rights, local police departments with the Stingray technology. And I won't be getting to it today, but later this week I'll report on the recent journalism about the Stingray program that is used at airports to monitor the cell phones of people sitting on planes before they take off or after they have landed. None of that is addressed by this wimpiest of wimpy bills, the USA Freedom Act. But as an editorial in the New York Times notes today, the prospect of anything remotely similar to this passing in the new Uber Republican Congress next year is almost zero. You got Mitch McConnell. And he says that at a time like this, with the threat of the Islamic State, that we cannot honor the constitutional rights of Americans. No, we must continue this massive surveillance. And if he can keep his caucus in line on those issues, then at least for the next 2 years, we have no opportunity for any movement to rein in the Obama spying regimes and try to restore some semblance of constitutional rule in this country. So yeah, I support passage of the USA Freedom Act because there's nothing else in the offing. But we've got to be honest about what it really would do, which is not a whole lot. And when you look at Ed Snowden, maybe you've seen Laura Poitras' new film, Citizen Four. Remember, one of the things he said was that his biggest fear is that he would risk so much to expose all of this information and then nothing would happen. And almost nothing has happened. Most Americans know that they can't trust their computers or their cell phones, or they can't know when they post on Facebook whether Big Brother is going to take that photo and put it in a file somewhere. But structurally, nothing significant has changed, nor will it, in the foreseeable future. Every day I acknowledge the people who support my work here through your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Chris Welsh, Joe Clarici, who doubles his monthly commitment, Annette McManus, and there's Chris Welsh again. Wow, Chris has two subscriptions. There are a few of you that do that. And I really appreciate those of you who express your support this way. Now, as I've told you recently, some people have ended their subscriptions, and you're free to do that. You know, there's no long-term contract here. And I don't second-guess the people who decide to end a subscription. There are many reasons for it. But I mention it to you because if you've been listening and you appreciate what you hear here, then I ask you to come forward and replace those who have, for whatever reason, ended their subscriptions. Just go to peterbcollins.com, look for my picture. It's pretty prominent there on the homepage. Under the picture, you'll see the sign-up link. That takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. And our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the continental U.S. qualify for that bonus CD from John Dist called Red Flag. Be happy to send you over a copy. Well, on Sunday, I was staying with a friend in Los Angeles, and she said, oh, let's turn on CNN. I really love Fareed Zakaria. And I watch Fareed, and, you know, he's interesting. He's different. He's not just your typical white guy. But Fareed paints right inside the lines. His crayons never go outside of the limits set by corporate and government leaders. And so it was interesting to see how he played some of the big stories. And then when his show was over, CNN went to the regular Newswheel coverage. And the lead story was the breaking news that another American has been killed by the Islamic State in what we're told is a beheading, videotaped and served up for propaganda value. Of course, we never see the actual video of the beheading, so we don't know for sure. We have to just take it on faith that that's what happened. The latest victim of the virtual guillotine operated by the Islamic State is a man from Indiana named Peter Kasich. He served in our military in Iraq. He was an Army Ranger. He was captured a year ago, October 1st. And he had founded a relief organization in Syria. And he is the latest victim. There are other Americans being held. There are other foreign nationals being held. And, of course, this is not really new. As Jeremy Scahill was able to point out on Bill Maher's show, Saudi Arabia beheads people on a regular basis. More than 59 people have been beheaded in Saudi Arabia this year alone. And we support many other governments that use brutal tactics, including regular executions, to maintain order. I was in Singapore earlier this year, and people told me every Friday they hold executions there. I believe they use hanging in Singapore. My point is that the outrage over the method in which these hostages are killed is used to stoke the fear. The White House, true to form, issued a statement from President Obama that this is an act of pure evil. And it is. What's missing is the context. that we conduct acts of pure evil on a much larger scale, on a much more frequent basis. But because we do it, it's okay. Because we're doing it, we tell ourselves, for all the right reasons. And so, while I certainly feel for the Kasich family who's lost their son Peter, I refuse to take the bait and to get all worked up because the Islamic State has done this again. And what's interesting to me is that in the same time frame that they're reporting on the beheading of Peter Kasich, we hear the report from the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey. Quote, we're going to need about 80,000 competent Iraqi security forces to recapture territory lost and eventually the city of Mosul to restore the border. Now, does Iraq have 80,000 effective military troops after $25 billion of U.S. training over a 6 to 8 year period? Well, everybody knows the answer to that is no. We cannot take the training wheels off the Iraqi bicycle. We know that. And so I believe that this is a 1-2 propaganda punch. Another beheading from IS produces predictable outrage from the United States, from the official organs of our government. And then we're told while we're cowering in the corner with the remote control that, yeah, you know, to wipe out these bastards, it's going to take 80,000 troops. And I expect that just as the president has trampled on his pledge not to put American troops on the ground in Iraq and Syria by committing at least 3,100 American troops to Iraq already, that what we're seeing is so similar to the way things were built up in Vietnam, starting in 1959-1960 when we inserted advisors there. And the combination of getting people all scared about the Islamic State and its tactics as a premise for the insertion of more American troops has me worked up, and you can hear Chloe in the background. She's not happy about it either. Here's another story of violence and mayhem that will be played up in the U.S. media without appropriate context over the next few days. Two Palestinians armed with a gun, knives, and axes stormed a synagogue complex in a Jewish neighborhood of West Jerusalem Tuesday morning and killed four men and a police officer. The four men, including three American Israelis, they hold dual citizenship. The fourth man was an Israeli, and the fifth dead person was an Israeli police officer. The two Palestinian assailants reportedly killed at the scene in a gun battle with police, and the officer there was later pronounced dead. It's the deadliest attack on Israeli civilians in more than 3 years, the worst in Jerusalem since 2008. And this occurred in the Har Nof neighborhood, shattering Israeli sense of security and further straining relations with Palestinians. Now, let me be very clear. I don't for a moment support this violence attributed to Palestinians. And while it pains me to ever agree even remotely with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, I do think that we've heard some irresponsible statements from Palestinian leaders, including those of Hamas, that may have encouraged or actually inspired these actions. But the context that will not be reported is that the Israelis have been limiting access to holy sites in Jerusalem by Muslims. And this has led to outrage and the remarks about days of rage. And that context will either be played down or eliminated entirely, as Americans are invited to mourn for those who died and to support the biblical-type retribution that will be exacted by Israel. We're already told that the homes of the two Palestinian assailants will be demolished as soon as tomorrow. And this is a typical act of retribution by the state of Israel. And it doesn't matter whether those men grew up in those homes. They may not even have still lived there. But if Israel can trace the individuals to a home, they will demolish that home. No legal process. They don't have to prove it. They don't have to establish that the suspects did the deed or that they lived in these homes. That's how Israel operates. And this will be condoned, if not praised, among our elected officials and in the Western media. And I predict that not a single media outlet or American elected official will in any way reference the brutal assault 51 days long that Israel conducted on Gaza this summer, or the way Israel used the pretext of the three kidnapped Israeli teens to round up members of Hamas and lock them up, even though everyone knows and knew at the time that Hamas was not directly responsible for those attacks. And so, yes, I deplore the incident that occurred today. And I further deplore the U.S. media that will not put it in any kind of a meaningful context and will instead allow Israel to spin this up for maximum political effect. We've seen this as well in the coverage of the G20 meeting, where Putin bashing was the sport of the day. And I guess I have to say this over and over again. I'm not a fan of Vladimir Putin. Vlad the Inhaler, or whatever, Vlad the Imposter, whatever you want to call him. But our media and the Western leaders clearly ganged up on Putin at this summit. And the purpose of these summits is to promote economic cooperation. But it was used as a political forum to demonize Russia and to further cement the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia since the takeover of Crimea earlier this year. And now we have a war of words between German Chancellor Merkel, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and Putin, and it's gotten kind of personal. They have squared off over Ukraine, Putin warning that Moscow will not accept a defeat for the pro-Russian rebels, and Merkel accusing the Kremlin of undermining peace across Europe. And there are certainly serious issues here. But name-calling, public shaming and denunciation, I think it's pretty obvious that a guy like Putin doesn't respond. Certainly doesn't respond positively to this kind of an approach. And the other piece is, of course, that like so many stories, so many incidents, so many cases, the U.S. has a narrative that paints Putin as always the bad guy. But not all of those chapters are accurate in that little book. And yet the media just hops on board. We saw so much attention paid to the fact that in Beijing, at one of these nighttime events where it got chilly, as he was posing as a gentleman, but Putin noticed that the wife of the Chinese leader was cold, and he found a shawl or a blanket and he put it over her shoulders. And this was played up like he was trying to put the moves on her in public or something like that. I mean, it's just bizarre. And that's one of the pieces that Fareed Zakaria picked up on as a launching point for a story that he did about Russia and about its deal with China for long-term natural gas sales and sharing. Finally today, an interesting story in today's New York Times about Al Sharpton. Now, Al Sharpton has a one-hour TV show every night on MSNBC. He showed up, of course, in Ferguson, Missouri this summer. Anywhere there is racial conflict in the United States, you can expect Al Sharpton to insert himself. And I don't give much credibility to Al Sharpton. I think he's a huckster, an opportunist, a self-promoter. And now we know he's a deadbeat. Al Sharpton and the groups that he runs that are supposed to be nonprofits are deeply in debt to the U.S. government for back taxes. They owe New York State and New York City six-figure sums for back taxes. And Al Sharpton, who confesses that he may not be a great manager of the organizations that he runs, he owes more than $4.5 million in current state and federal tax liens against him and his for-profit and nonprofit entities. And he has messy financial dealings with the entities he controls. His National Action Network appears to have been sustained for years by not paying the federal payroll taxes on its employees. And I'm not surprised by these disclosures. Al Sharpton is a guy who thinks that he can hold other people accountable, but that he himself is above any kind of questions, responsibility, or accountability that he owes just as a citizen, as well as a self-styled civil rights leader. And I'm not interested in destroying Al Sharpton. He's an American who is free to express himself. He occasionally, I think, performs a good function in brokering communication or understanding between groups that are not on the same page. But it doesn't change who he really is. If you want to read it, find it in today's New York Times at nytimes.com. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you are authorized to share with absolutely anyone. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.